broadcasting in HD Radio at 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is author and journalist Seth Shulman. His new book, The Telephone Gambit, examines the invention of the telephone, which is not the Don Ameche version, as it turns out. Seth Shulman has also written Unlocking the Sky, a book about the Wright brothers' rival Glenn Curtiss, and Undermining Science, Suppression and Distortion in the Bush Administration, as well as many other things. Seth Shulman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
You love to make trouble, don't you?
I don't know about that. In this case, I didn't set out to make any trouble, and this was going to be a break from troublemaking, actually. So there's some irony there.
So trouble just follows you.
I guess so. No, I mean, you know, this is a very odd. It's completely nonfiction, and this book tells my story of completely by accident stumbling on information in Alexander Graham Bell's own lab book that pretty conclusively shows that he plagiarized the telephone, the key element that made the telephone possible, from his main rival, a guy named Elisha Gray.
And he did this, you think, completely knowingly and maliciously?
Yes. I mean, you know, what happened to me is that I am, as you said earlier, I'm a journalist, and I write mostly about contemporary things, and I was invited to spend the year with a group of historians at MIT. It was the first time they'd ever decided to have kind of a writer-in-residence, and I had proposed to them to look at some of our icons of invention, people like Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell, largely because I cover a lot of modern day invention, and I thought it'd be really interesting to try and see what I could learn about the way they did their work, and you know, just look into it. And I started reading Alexander Graham Bell's laboratory notebooks, which actually anybody can do. They're available in a high resolution digital format from the Library of Congress, so they're up on the web, and they make for very fascinating reading. And the first thing that happened is that I noticed that that Alexander Graham Bell had been working away with really not that great success for about a year, trying to get a device together that would work to transmit voice. And then 2 days before that fateful day when he calls to Watson in the next room, he dramatically changed his research. And, you know, my first thought was, you know, what a brilliant guy. And then I noticed in the notebook that he has a notation in there that said that he had been down in Washington for 2 weeks. And so he came back from a trip to Washington, moving in a dramatically different direction that bore fruit almost immediately. So that really piqued my interest, and I was with all these top-notch historians, and I thought to myself, you know, well, this is kind of what these historians do. You know, I'm going to try and find out what it was in Washington, D.C. that set him on a different course.
Did it occur to you that, I'm sorry, but did it occur to you that if, you know, if there was something unusual, that other historians would certainly have found it out by now? I mean, did you ever think
absolutely. I mean, I thought maybe I'd just, you know, what basically this would be shedding a little more light or getting some insight into how he worked or where he got his ideas from, or I didn't, you know, it was a fishing expedition basically, but I had the luxury because I was there for the year of getting to do this, and I was kind of excited about it. You know, I thought to myself, well, this is what these historians do. I mean, I don't really know where this is going to lead, but what fun to look into it. And the amazing thing about Alexander Graham Bell is that he wrote absolutely everything down. You know, he wrote letters every day. He wrote in his journal. He wrote in his laboratory notebooks, and it's all been saved. And much of it is in the Library of Congress collection, which contains something like 147,000 documents, all of which you can call up on the computer. So anyway, what happened is almost immediately after I started on this train of research, I noticed that that Bell's rival, a guy named Elisha Gray, had filed, made a patent filing some 3 weeks earlier. And when I took a look at it, I nearly fell out of my chair. It was virtually identical to a sketch that was drawn into Bell's laboratory notebook when he returns from Washington. So here, Bell came back from Washington. He drew in his lab notebook in his own handwriting a diagram that's virtually identical to something that had been filed at the patent office by his rival some 3 weeks earlier. And it was this device that led directly to the success of the telephone just 2 days later. So, immediately I was just flooded with questions. How could this possibly have happened? Why wouldn't Elisha Gray have screamed bloody murder when Bell came out with a device that was so identical to his own? And then, of course, the question you asked, which is how could it possibly be that no one had noticed this in more than 130 years?
Well, you mentioned that Bell's papers were well kept. What about Gray? Did he keep papers? Are his papers examinable?
Well, they are, but it turned out to be quite a hard job. They are, the Bell collection is just a fabulous example of what the computer can really do, and it just makes it so easy to be able to. Not only do you get to see when you call them up, you can see the actual documents themselves in Bell's own handwriting or whoever's, but you can also do keyword searching, so you can look for, when he happens to write about Elisha Gray and get all the documents about that or a certain date or whatever you want. Elisha Gray's papers, there are many of them, but they tend to be spread out in different archives, and they're all in paper form, which means that that they're often in collections that make them really pretty hard to get access to and get your hands on. Once I noticed this, I describe it in the book as kind of falling through a historical trap door. And as I started to look into this matter, everything that I was finding was so at odds with that classic tale that we all have heard about the invention of the telephone. And the story just seemed to get fishier and fishier that I decided pretty soon on that I would spend the rest of my time there just really trying to get to the bottom of it. And that's what I did. And I ended up going to many archives around the country to try and put all the pieces together.
Well, naturally, I have a million questions, and I want to know more about it. We're talking with Seth Shulman, and his new book is called The Telephone Gambit. Well, but let me ask you this. Tell us a little bit, before we really get into the whole mystery that you unraveled, tell us a little bit about Bell. What kind of a guy was Alexander Graham Bell?
Well, he was an amazing and interesting guy. I started researching him out of admiration, and I still have a lot of admiration for him. He was extremely curious about the world around him, very well liked by almost everybody that knew him. He was from an immigrant from Scotland, and as many of your listeners probably know, he's famous as a teacher of the deaf. And he came from a long line of people who specialized in teaching about speech and people who made their living basically as orators and speech coaches. This is what his father and his grandfather had done. And in fact, his father was really quite famous for it and was the model for the character Henry Higgins in George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion, which became the musical My Fair Lady. So if people remember Henry Higgins, this is at least in part modeled after, it says so right in Shaw's original version of the play, that it's modeled after the illustrious Alexander Melville Bell, who was Bell's father. So he was kind of a grand Victorian character, and what distinguished him from his forebears is that he was living in a time where it was really the golden age of invention, and technology was just changing dramatically. And so he applied some of the family business and techniques. He started applying some of the modern technology to some of the problems that his father and grandfather had had looked into, and this work, both teaching the deaf and then thinking about the ability to transmit both speech and also make improvements on the telegraph, this fascinated him, and he sort of did some of his inventing in his spare time, basically. But, you know, he was a struggling immigrant, pretty much, and living in Boston, in the Boston area. And, you know, if people have a picture of Bell, it's often as this, the one that people have often seen is this white-haired, you know, benevolent-looking guy. But the interesting thing to say is that this episode with the telephone, this tremendous fame and fortune that came to Bell, came when he was just 29 years old. And dramatically changed, of course, not just his life, but
our lives, right?
Our lives, yeah. Right? Exactly.
Well, so do you think it, you know, it should rightfully have been called Gray Telephone instead of Bell Telephone?
Well, you know, I as kind of a sidelight to the mystery that I get into in the book, I actually talk about the fact that there were a number of people who deserve credit for the telephone. But in particular, you know, I got on this trail, as I said, that's just so at odds with the standard tale that we've been told. And in this case, I think there's no question that Elisha Gray was cheated out of the credit that he deserves for having invented something called the liquid transmitter, which was the first device that really reliably was able to transmit the voice, to change the sound waves of your voice into current that could be carried on a telegraph wire. This was really the stumbling block. You know, the telephone has two parts to it, basically. There's the so-called receiver, which is the part you listen into, and the transmitter, which is the part you speak into, and it was the transmitter that was giving Bell so much trouble over the previous year. And the device that worked, that he called to Watson on, was actually a liquid transmitter identical to one designed, invented and designed by Elisha Gray. So in that sense, he certainly deserves a tremendous amount of credit.
And what did you learn about Elisha Gray? What kind of a person was he?
Well, Elisha Gray was a Midwestern son of farmers, and was a farmer himself, born into poverty. His father died when he was very young, and so he really struggled. But he had tremendous ability for tinkering, basically, and was really turned out to be just absolutely a world class inventor. He was some 12 years Bell senior, and especially at around the time that this story takes place, at the invention of the telephone, he was no doubt more famous than Bell, because he had made a lot of very important improvements to the telegraph, which was absolutely booming at the time. It had really taken off, and people were sending telegrams all the time. And some of Elisha Gray's inventions and improvements on the telegraph were successful enough that he actually was able to go back to school and at Oberlin College in Ohio, and ultimately to sell his company to Western Union, which was the virtual monopoly on the telegraph at the time. His company became called Western Electric and was one of the major manufacturers to Western Union. So Elisha Gray was doing okay. He also, among many other things, does get credit for having invented one of the very first fax machines. So he was really an amazing guy, had many, many patents and inventions to his credit. Most of them had to do with the telegraph and transmitting, you know, both messages of all kinds, including voice.
Well, so let me ask you about patents in general. You seem to know a lot about that. So if Gray had taken out a patent or something like a patent on this device, wouldn't that have been put in a drawer somewhere? I mean, how would Bell have been able to see it when he went into the patent office?
Right. Well, this was certainly, you know, one of the many, many questions that I had about how this whole thing could have occurred in the way it did. I mean, it's really quite a twisted tale, as it turns out. And the amazing thing, I mean, one of the nice things about this book is that the publisher, W.W. Norton, was very good about letting me put a lot of pictures and documents into the book. So I include a lot of things. People don't have to just take my word or my interpretation of the story. They can look at some of these things for themselves. I mean, we talked about a sketch in Bell's notebook. It's in there. People can look at it and see. I'm not just making it up, that it's virtually identical to Elisha Gray's drawing. This was just one of the big key mysteries of how Bell could have gotten access. As I said, it's a twisted tale with corruption in surprising places. The amazing thing is really, to me, is how much ultimately I was able to unearth about this. There's really so many documents that point to it. I think most people, by the time they get to the end, will be convinced by the information that I present. In the case you're talking about, it hinges on a guy named Zenas Fisk Wilbur, who was the patent examiner in charge of all inventions pertaining to the telegraph, and the telephone was certainly one of them. In this case, I was able to, in the archives at Oberlin College, of all places, find a handwritten affidavit, a sworn statement from this guy before he died that said that, in fact, he had illegally shown Bell Elisha Gray's filing. He even explains why he did it. He said that he was an alcoholic, and he owed money to one of the partners in the law firm representing Bell, a guy who he had actually served in the military with. He had been his commanding officer in the Civil War. So he felt indebted, and he broke every rule and broke the law to do this. This is what he wrote considerably after the fact and before he died, and went to his grave maintaining that was the truth about what happened. And it does comport with many, many other bits and pieces that I was able to uncover in the book. So as far as that goes, that's just one tiny piece of how this whole thing unraveled. And, you know, what's great about this story is that it all takes place over the course of 1 year in 1876. So in a sense, it's a kind of a small story about a bitter rivalry between two amazing inventors of the time and the backers and lawyers and people that they were involved in. So it's got a really amazing kind of cast of characters. But the thing about it is the twists and turns of this story end up just having such a, you know, they really changed history. This is still considered to be the most lucrative patent ever issued in the United States, the so-called telephone patent. And of course, it led directly to one of the largest monopolies the world has ever known.
Seth Shulman is my guest, and his book is called The Telephone Gambit, Chasing Alexander Graham Bell's Secret. What about Watson? Was Watson part of this theft?
Well, I don't think Watson was part of it personally, although there's a lot more research that can be done on many, many parts of this whole story, and some of it's already being done, which is one of the really fun things about working on a project like this. Everyone from the curator of the Bell collection at the Library of Congress to, in fact, I just got email from a guy who's writing something about Watson and is very interested, having, you know, really gone over a lot of Watson's papers about how this intersects with a lot of what he's finding. So the fun thing about history, of course, is that there's many, many rocks to turn over in different parts. Watson had an absolutely incredible life, and I wish I could have even put him more in the book than he was. But at the time when the story that I tell was taking place, he was very young. Bell was 29. He was considerably younger. My guess, and again, this is sort of partially speculation, is that he had a sense of some of what was going on, but But I think, you know, he absolutely idolized Bell, and I think he was kept to a certain extent in the dark. The way they tended to work is that Bell would come up with a design, and Watson was the machinist and the very skilled craftsman who would build the prototypes. And so, his eyebrows might have gone up when they made such a dramatic shift, but on the other hand, he was very much the assistant and the builder, and Bell was very much the designer. So I think it's quite possible that he wouldn't have questioned so much exactly how things were going.
Well, what I want to know is, has there been an outcry? You know, I mean, here you're messing with, you know. it's been in our history books forever. We had the movie with Donna Meachie and Henry Fonda, and now you're saying it's wrong. I mean, has there been, have Bell's family, I don't know if he's got a family anymore, but I mean, if people come and said you're libelously accusing,
he certainly has the descendants. There has been surprisingly little of that, in fact. And part of that is because this is no kind of hatchet job on Alexander Graham Bell. I did uncover some things, but on the other hand, I think it's a fairly sympathetic portrayal, and I tried to be really pretty, both careful and also even-handed in the way I present some of this. So interestingly enough, a lot of the scholars, and I guess the other thing to say about that is that it also came, in the book, I tell the story, it's written as a kind of detective story that describes my year trying to get to the bottom of this thing. And one of the amazing parts of it is that I had all these top-notch historians as my colleagues for the year, and they helped me tremendously. And I had to present my findings to this group of historians from MIT and Harvard at the end of the year. And so these guys helped to a great degree to make sure that I had done my homework well. And so I think that also helps in some sense to stave off some of the controversy that, oh, this is just some quack of a guy reinterpreting or doing some kind of revisionist history.
First he goes after the Wright brothers, and then he goes after President Obama.
Yeah, well, you know, that actually, if you really want to know, that was something that made me hesitant to even go into this, because I had, I've written, this is my fifth book, and one of my books is a revisionist history that was timed at the Wright brothers' anniversary to laud a different guy, Glenn Curtis, who I think did an awful lot for early aviation, and I, on purpose, sort of did a different take that didn't feature the Wright brothers quite as much. But this is a very different kind of project, but because I had done that, I was, you know, it did actually make me hesitant to want to get involved in a similar activity. And I thought, well, you know, who would believe what I say? I mean, after all, you do have this daunting, everything from learning to read books, technical encyclopedias, you name it, electronics textbooks, reporting the history in a certain way, and it's a very daunting collection of stuff to go up against. But the amazing thing is that as I said, you know, I think most people who actually read the book find, to their surprise, that it's really a fun read and kind of a twisted tale, and also that. That for the most part they seem very persuaded. Now, the one thing to say on this is that there was a funny article in the Washington Post where one of Bell's descendants took great umbrage at the book and said all sorts of things about it and was very displeased about it. And ultimately, the interviewer asked him whether he'd actually read it or even seen it, and he admitted that he hadn't. We actually did send the book to some of Bell's descendants, but he had never seen it, according to him, and so it, at least to some degree, undercut his
argument. Yeah.
His criticism.
Well,
yeah.
How did you decide as a writer to put yourself into the book?
Well, that was a very tough decision about this book because, I've worked as a journalist for for decades now, and that's something that I don't usually do. In fact, I can't remember. You know, occasionally in an article, there's a reason why you interject yourself, but there's a lot of reluctance to do that, I think, in journalism. And in this case, I think, you know, the real reason that I opted to do it is because of my experience trying to write a full-length historical narrative nonfiction book before about aviation. And what I discovered in doing that, and there are a lot of people that do it very well, but I really came to feel that it's not as honest a form in some ways as I'd like it to be, because so many of the really interesting and good parts of history are the mystery parts, the parts that we don't really know what happened. And as a writer, when you're trying to create a story out of the past and you're trying to do it in a fairly scrupulous nonfiction way, you always get to a point, inevitably, where you come up to the day where you don't have a letter or you don't have documentation that really shows what was going on. And a lot of times that can be the crux of some of the most interesting parts of history. And so by putting myself in and by having the reader kind of come with me as I struggled through some of those parts, all the parts that I didn't understand, how could Bell have gotten access? How could, Gray have responded? And often I'd go to some of my historian colleagues and really discuss that or get their advice on how you can, you know, what documents could you look for? How can you build a case or come to a feeling like you really understand in a conclusive way what happened in the past? And so I wanted to get at that theme of how we understand history and how we misunderstand it a lot of the time. And so that was really why I decided to sort of tell it from the perspective of me as the sort of bumbling detective trying to make sense of this thing that I had stumbled on.
The book is called The Telephone Gambit, Chasing Alexander Graham Bell's Secret. The author is Seth Shulman. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf, but I'll be back next week with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her help. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening, everybody.